Lend Me Your Ears, the Oral Dramaturgies Podcast. The Gallery, interviews with artists.
Hello. Today in the gallery, we meet Abby Greenland and Helen Golan, founders of the music, dance and theatre collective Rash Dash. As they recall in this conversation, Abby and Helen met at university and set up Rash Dash in 2009. Their musical collaborator Becky Wilkie subsequently joined as a core member of the ensemble. Since their earliest outings at the National Student Drama Festival and the Edinburgh Fringe, Rash Dash have distinguished themselves through a highly individual performance idiom which hybridizes musical, corporeal and textual dramaturgies together in a way that defies categorization. In this interview, a rare one in the series to have been conducted in person before the COVID-19 lockdown, we retrace the company's journey over the intervening 10 years and talk about the making of some of their memorable hits, such as The Two-Man Show, premiered in 2017, and Three Sisters, premiered in 2018. The company's frequently stated idealism, revaluing of the feminine, radical generosity and honest contemplation are present in this conversation too. The interview took place on the 16th of January 2020 at the Longfield Hall in South London.
So, thank you very much for making this possible, this conversation. I just wanted to sort of have an opportunity to talk to you about your work and how it's developed over the years, because your work seems to be very representative of the kind of things I'm looking at as part of this project, the way in which you've sort of led the way with gig theatre, or what we now call gig theatre. We probably didn't call it that when you were sort of developing the form, but it seems to be sort of like one of the definitive examples that people often cite when they talk about form of gig theatre, for example. And I guess it's probably because of the way in which music is built into the way in which you make work. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that you had a Hull connection and that was the time and the place where you came together. So maybe just going back there too, when was it that you were in Hull? What were the years?
We were there 2006 to 2009, okay. Which now feels like a very long time ago. The first thing we did together, we worked, because we did the same course at Hull University, so we did like a little bit of work within our course. We made a very strange thing as part of a module. I don't even know what module that was, the one with the cogs, and it was Arthur and Lancelot and the knights, something about the round table. It was bizarre. It was a kind of bizarre thing. But we sort of enjoyed working together. We didn't really enjoy what we made, but we enjoyed working together and experimenting together. And then we...
I remember bashing little corrugated pieces of metal that we kept calling croc dogs.
Oh, yeah.
Into bits of wood and then wrapping the wood in cellophane.
Because
and then,
we were like, building our set,
and
yeah.
And pressing ourselves up against the cellophane.
Yeah.
So we're making, like, cellophane frames.
Yes.
And then being Arthur and Lancelot.
Yeah.
Wearing suits.
We were probably dictators within that process. Yeah. In a really, like, not very, probably very nice way. But it just... but I guess we kind of discovered in working in that way that we had, like, a similar... like desire for something to be something, to be really good, and not that that was really good, but you know, had a similar sort of drive and energy behind a project. And then we directed something terrible at the Edinburgh Fringe. This was all sort of, this was pre-Rash Dash really. So, but it was like finding a way of working together. And that was where we saw Do Theatre, that Fringe, which was at the end of our first year of university. Mm-hmm. And beyond, like, seeing the stuff that we saw there, which
was... We saw
was,
a lot at Aurora Nova that year.
We did, yeah.
And seeing Do Theatre together was big in that I don't think I'd seen theatre without words before. I think I'd seen dance and I'd seen theatre.
I'd seen Gecko by that point, I think, because I'd seen The Race.
Yes,
like
I remember
the
that
year
being
before
big
or
for you.
Something. Mm-hmm. Which, yeah, that was definitely really big for me as well, being like, oh, theatre can be this, like,
weird, experimental, but also fun and dance and...
And really political, The Race, right?
The race was about fatherhood,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And, like, the race of life.
Right.
So I think it's less political. But yeah, the Arab and the Jew. I didn't see that one, actually. But yeah, we kind of came away from that festival and were like, again, didn't really like what we made, found that all quite difficult, working with lots of people and lots of bodies, but we enjoyed working together, so let's just do something that's just us, mm-hmm. and let's perform in it, because that's the thing that we're interested in doing as well, like being performers in the work, but making it ourselves.
And that's just the two of you at that
just
point.
The two of us. And that piece was entirely physical with no words at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called Strip Machine. It had a feminist agenda, but not a particularly specific one.
It wasn't a very sophisticated message. I think I can remember talking about the glass ceiling a lot when we were making that, which is just hilarious now, considering that we were just at uni and nothing had really got in our way in terms of that. We were just like, well, the glass ceiling's awful, we must smash it. And so we put on black and white suits and made a show about smashing the glass ceiling. And I remember that when we took it to National Student Drama Festival, lots of people were kind of talking to us about this interest in the fact that we had chosen a very 80s aesthetic,
mm-hmm.
and we had no idea we had chosen an 80s aesthetic. So taking our work to a festival where other students could watch it, but also where a load of professionals could watch it, was interesting because we realised how out of control we were mm-hmm. of what we were doing,
mm-hmm.
and that we were doing something we liked, but that we weren't really making strong enough, controlled enough decisions about all of the messages that we put on stage. Outside, we just like singing and dancing and we're feminists.
Mm-hmm.
So the next show we made had a guy in it, Mark Graham, who's in Middle Child now.
Mm-hmm.
And we made a show called Never Enough. This was still at uni as well.
Mm-hmm.
So this is our third year piece. We took it back to the Student Drama Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that was around the beginning of the time where we decided, shall we go off and train separately or shall we just do the company thing now? And Adam Ledger, who maybe teaches at Birmingham now,
yeah,
but was teaching at Hull at the time, said, if you start a company now, then you'll be poor and not knowing what you want to do at the same time as all of your friends are poor and don't know what they want to do. Whereas if you do training, do acting, then get together and start a company in like 5 or 6 years, everyone else will kind of have money and know what they're doing and you'll be at the beginning again. And I remember that being a real strong persuader for me, just going, yeah, now's the time to do it, now's the time to take a punt.
Did he say that to us specifically, or was it more of like a general, because I
he said it to us in his office when we'd gone in there and we were like, we might start a company. He was like, if you're going to do it now, essentially.
Yeah.
Which was really good advice.
Yeah.
And then we made Another Someone, which was, after we graduated, the first show we made, we stayed in Hull.
Honeymoon?
Abby, Honeymoon. Sorry, Helen's got the better memory. We made The Honeymoon, which is about two women who were having a double wedding who both decided to run away from their husbands.
Mm-hmm.
Another...
And was that the Rashda show?
That was a Rashda show.
And that was, I suppose, in a way, the first Rashda show, because it was the first one outside of a university environment.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
we took that to Edinburgh, performed it at Bedlam, and it also had Becky in it. So she has been there from the beginning, which some people are kind of surprised by, because there was a long period where she wasn't in the company.
But also because in that one she stood at the back and looked down whenever she wasn't playing, hilariously. We had a very unsophisticated approach to music, which was, Becky wrote some brilliant songs. I still really like some of the songs from that, although I question a lot of the lyrics. And she stood at the back, and every so often we would go to the side, pick up a microphone, bring it to the middle, and just sing. I remember Holly Kendrick, who was running Student Festival at the time, saying, that's fine if that's what you want to do, but maybe have a think about that.
Because
we weren't really in control again. We were kind of, we want to sing now, I need the microphone to be in the middle, it's in the way if it's there all the time. A kind of low budget.
And lots of things that you might... Like, if someone had been on the outside of a process with us, they might have been going, oh, let's have a think about how we manage this moment. But there was a lot of, I guess, just a lot of stuff that we were sort of just ignoring and going, let's just, like, do this in the most kind of functional way possible.
Because there was no outside eye or director.
And it's always been that. It's always been led by performers doing what they want to do, I think.
But we knew, like, around the time that we were making that last show at the National Student Drama Festival, Never Enough, we were really kind of desperate by that point to have music in the work, mm-hmm. and were sort of going, how do we do this, how do we do this, and didn't feel confident enough to sort of make that happen ourselves. And so bringing Becky in was like an amazing thing that really shifted the shows and made them much more music.
How did that happen? How did Becky become?
Abby's known Becky for years and years.
Me and Becky met when we were 11 at high school. Mm. So it's one of those things where she was in a school band and they were really good. It's not like, you know, they played some kind of shitty covers badly. She's always been an excellent, well, since she learned to play the piano, she's been an excellent pianist. She's a brilliant songwriter. And I remember going to gigs when I was 16, 17 in the pubs around where, you know, local teenage bands played.
In Manchester, presumably?
No, so I grew up in Suffolk.
In Suffolk,
So it was around Ipswich, Colchester area, village pubs.
Okay.
And loads and loads of people would come to their gigs. It wasn't like, you know, oh, please come. It was always a big event when she was in a band called Charlie Brown that then became Making Eyes at Elvis. And they were really good. And I had played a CD of Becky's high school music to Helen in the kitchen, and Helen had really enjoyed it. And so when I said we could ask Becky to come and write songs for the honeymoon, she was like, yeah, sure. Becky was in her second year studying English at Bristol, and I think was questioning having abandoned music and feeling like she hadn't really brought out her musical side at university at all, mm-hmm. and yet it was a really big part of her. So she said, yes, I'll come and live in Hull for 6 weeks and then come to Edinburgh Festival as part of my mm-hmm. holiday, and I'm so glad she did.
I'm interested to hear a bit more about those sort of musical influences that you brought individually to this space of working together. So like you just mentioned, that interest in the music scene in Ipswich and so on. I just want to dig a little deeper there in terms of what were other formative influences on you as individuals that you could associate your aesthetic to?
In Strict Machine, we sang a song at the beginning of the show, which is the first show we made together. I think we rewrote the lyrics to
Missed Me.
Amanda Palmer's Dresden Dolls' Missed Me. Mm-hmm. And I think that Dresden Dolls were a big influence early on, and the kind of angry cabaret.
Mm-hmm. Also Meow Meow as well, but maybe less the, from a musical point of view, mm-hmm. although she is obviously a singer, but more from a performance point of view, but that kind of cabaret world. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think also musical theatre, mm-hmm. to a certain extent.
As in West End musicals.
Yeah. And kind of older ones like Cabaret, the musical. Mm-hmm, like mm-hmm, mm-hmm, I think I kind of grew up being quite into all of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Camille O'Sullivan I remember as well. Mm-hmm. But again, like being really into her performance, mm-hmm. that sort of like really bold, semi-improvised, mm-hmm. big personality.
But in terms of the music that we were playing in the room, not necessarily just the music that we were singing to, we would go from listening to the Chemical Brothers and Prodigy and Orbital and those kind of techno world to listening to a Finnish band called Sumi Sound System that changed the time signature in their track every, you know, five bars and have a wild combination of instruments to Bjork to some more classical stuff.
And very poppy stuff, like Rihanna and Beyonce. And yeah, and I think your dad was really great at like putting in some more obscure world music choices, mm-hmm. that like Sumi Sound System, that have then kind of led to us being able to discover more and more things.
Because my dad is a musician and he listens to a lot of world music. I remember saying to Ian, that's his name, we just want some more music. We just want some more stuff that's not got lyrics that we can mm-hmm. have in the room. And he supplied us with the loads. But I remember that coming from being emboldened by seeing Gecko again. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe this is The Overcoat.
The Overcoat, yeah.
And they use a real smorgasbord of world music in that. Mm-hmm. It goes from Bulgarian nuns to Elvis or something croonery at one point. Yeah. And I remember just being like, oh yeah, we can do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that palette, that like diversity of palette, has always been a really exciting thing that we've looked for. And I think that we really sort of pushed that to its full extent in Three Sisters, being like, let's have a rock song, a punk song, a pop song, a ballad, a musical theatre number, and
rap.
Just go like wild with the genre. And that was very intentional and really fun to do.
Work for the future, work for the kids. You gotta work, 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 work. Britney said work, bitch. Missy said work, kid. We all say work. Now show me how you work, work. Don't work for the same. Work for the country. Work for the soul. Work for more power. Don't work for control. Work for the unheard. Work for the unseen. Work for the unhappy and all in between. Just keep on working because it's begun. Work to continue the rebellion.
Kind of interesting. I feel like now that we've done that, we might not on the next thing. Mm. And actually, I remember Becky saying recently,
no more rock.
She was like, I've had enough. Like, I don't want a drum kit. I don't want a guitar. Like, let's just make this vocals and piano. And so actually, yeah, we did a sharing of a show called Mary versus Elizabeth, which is in development at the moment, which is about Mary Stuart, Mary Tudor, and Elizabeth I. Mm-hmm. And that's got a lot of music in it, but at the moment the only instrumentation is very stripped back drums, a synth, and a piano. It was a grand piano that we were using, which was kind of wonderful, and voices. Mm-hmm. So the sound, like the spectrum of song is, I guess it's smaller. But there is still real diversity in that as well. Like there's folk and there's pop and there's, I don't know how else I'd describe the music in that. Kind of rap, but in musical theatre world.
That synthy one that I randomly wrote, it feels much more like it's in the world of Yorkie, James Blakey.
Yeah, Imogen Heapy.
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah, I would describe that as pop, but I guess
Just weird. It feels like pop. I always feel like you kind of got a structure to it, and that one just
it's not a 4/4. It's like more of an experimental pop sound.
Yeah.
So going back to Hull, I also remember you saying that last time when I heard you talk about your work, that what was useful, helpful in that particular kind of training was the way in which you got to make everything. So it wasn't just about kind of training to be a performer, training to be, I don't know, a designer, but you actually had to make the actual sets and so on as part of that time there. Was there a particular reason why either you chose Hull as a place?
I only put it on my list because there were five places I was interested in going to, and there's a sixth place on the UCAS form, and my mum had gone, so I thought, well, I'll put down Hull, and that'll just fill up my form.
Okay.
And then they were the first people to offer me an interview, and I thought, well, I'll go and I'll practice interviewing there. And when I went, it felt like none of the students were very interested in ego, or none of the students I met on that day. They were very friendly, very warm, and I remember somebody who I then met when I was there and still know, said, if you get in, you should come here because it's really fun and we all just make stuff. And I remember thinking, that's exactly what I want. I want to make stuff with other people who want to make stuff. Mm. I'm kind of, I do want to get taught. I do want all of the modules. That's fab. But the idea of being in a theatre as much as I wanted to be, and no one saying, okay, you only have rehearsals on Tuesdays and Thursdays, 7 till 9.30, which was my youth theatre times, was like, yes, hungry, hungry for that. And I think, I feel like also what I really wanted was to go to Hull and meet someone like you. And it worked. I think I always wanted to start a theatre company.
What about your choice?
I applied to 4 universities, I think. The Bristol, Exeter, Royal Holloway and Hull. But I got a place at Royal Holloway and Hull, so then was deciding between those two. And I think I always thought I would favour Royal Holloway, actually. And I did really like it, and I enjoyed my interview, and... It was cool, but I didn't want to be an Egham. That's what it came down to. I was like, I don't want to go to university in London and sort of be on the outskirts of London. And although I was a bit like, but what's Hull going to be like? And I was a little bit sceptical about, in quite a snobby way, probably, because of the bad press. And I think Hull's changed a lot, and I think that it being like the European Capital of Culture, like Hull 2017, like so much has happened. But I was a bit like, don't know. But it just felt, I was just more drawn to it between the two of them. And we just happened to have like the most amazing year and like fantastic years above us as well. And like really inspiring people, really down-to-earth people, really unpretentious people.
Mm-hmm. But also hungry for it. Like, think about the fact that Rush Dash and Middle Child both came out of our year group. Mm-hmm. That's quite like a high percentage of people who are really, really hungry for it, whatever it is.
And our Middle Child... So Middle Child have kind of stayed in Hull.
They have, yeah.
Yeah. And well, why was that? Why do you think...
I mean, well, they didn't form straight out of uni. They left. Lots of them went to university... drama school even. And then Paul Smith, who's the director, I think he wasn't quite finding what he wanted to find out on his own, and he knew that a lot of his friends who were actors who had also graduated from Hull at the same time as us weren't. So he said he sent like a big group email and was like, anyone who wants to come and be part of the beginning. I think he wrote a manifesto. I think he went totally old school on it. Wrote a manifesto. Everyone came, and there were 13 of them initially that said they wanted to move back to Hull because they identified a place that there was a need for it and where they wouldn't be crowded out. I think they were all feeling like, what the fuck's here for us in London? It's very crowded.
It's very cheap to live in as well. It sort of feels like
you
a place...
You can be poor there.
Yeah, the whole setting up a company thing feels more doable in a place like that, as well as that thing about there being a need for it, like that they're not... Yeah, it's not saturated, and there's loads more going on there now, I think. But at that time, it was like, well, actually, we could be really useful here, as well as have space to make things.
Not have to work all of the hours just to pay rent, therefore we can do this theatre company.
So they chose that other option that Adam was talking about. The option of like going to train and then coming back.
Yeah, because a lot of them did do that. A lot of them did postgrads in acting or directing, and then came back together.
Yeah,
they were really inspired by that article, weren't they? Is it? I always forget which Mike it is. Is it Mike Bartlett?
Yeah.
Who
Steal a Van? That
Steal
one.
A Van.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just do your own thing because you'll probably like get more out of it. I remember that being quite formative.
So when you made Another Someone, which was probably the show that put you on the map, right? Am I right?
Yeah.
It was the three of you and a couple of other people.
Mark Graham, again.
There was a guy. I don't remember.
He's
a guy.
In Middle Child, and he had been in our graduation show, I guess. Never Enough. So it was the four of us on stage, right? There was no one else. And that was when Becky went from being on the piano at the back to being on the piano at the front.
Okay.
And talking.
Okay. Was it described as gig theatre at the time?
I don't think so.
I don't think so, no. I think it was... I remember people kind of struggling a bit with the definition mm-hmm. of it, but in quite an interesting way. Mm-hmm. Like, what do we call this? It's not musical theatre, but mm-hmm. it's kind of, and it's not a play, but it's like mm-hmm. it's a show.
And it had dance in it as well.
Yes.
I feel like the first time anyone called what we did a gig was when we made Scary Gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And that's because we were working with a band and they had electrical instruments. And so it felt like it felt like the song parts of the show felt more like a gig than a theatre.
And that was the next show after Another Song.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was.
And was that also in Edinburgh? Is that where you launched
Scary? Bedlam again. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We worked with a band called Not Now Bernard.
And that show felt much more overtly political, mm-hmm. I suppose, mm-hmm. Because it was about pornography.
And the first of our shows about porn.
Yeah, because mm-hmm. we felt like, I mean, it's a very difficult thing to make a show about, mm-hmm. and we felt like with that show we hadn't kind of got to the core of what we wanted to say, and maybe we didn't with the next attempt either. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that felt like a shift for that reason, Scary Gorgeous, because we were like, oh, there's this thing that feels like it's really affecting the relationships of young people, and let's examine that, let's talk about mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm.
And did you, at some point, because I remember reading about one of your shows being co-produced by Latitude, or Latitude Festival being somehow involved.
Yeah.
This is also interesting, you know, that you talked about the NSDF. So there was like the NSDF and then Edinburgh, and then Latitude came on the scene at some point.
Really, it was the Lyric Hammersmith. Mm-hmm. So at that point, they were commissioning companies that were kind of new mm-hmm. To make outdoor work. Mm-hmm. They were the people commissioning, but the money came from Lyric, Greenwich and Docklands International mm-hmm. Festival, Latitude, and was there a fourth?
Imagine Watford.
So,
and which piece was that?
So we made both Set Fire to Everything and The Frenzy mm-hmm. with that group of commissioners.
And when was that?
2012, 13, because mm-hmm. mm-hmm. it was 2 years in a row.
Was that your first outdoors?
Yes. Set Fire to Everything was first.
I was going to say first and last, but that's not true, because we made The Darkest Corners. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Quite hard working outside.
Yeah.
I'm not a massive fan of it.
The reason I'm asking you about this is because I'm wondering to what extent the producing model might contribute to the form. If you knew that you were making work for a particular kind of venue, or a particular kind of context, let's say the Edinburgh Festival or the Latitude Festival, would that determine, or did that determine, the choices you were making in terms of how you were making the show?
I think it did. For those outdoor shows, it was quite specific what they needed to be, mm-hmm. because the Lyric sort of said to us, it needs to be like no longer than half an hour, I think. It has to be able to be repeated like 3 times a day. Mm-hmm. People need to be able to come across it and immediately access it or get something from it. Mm-hmm.
But what I would say is the other companies that were commissioned at the same time, because they commissioned 4 each time, responded to exactly the same brief, but chose not to put live music in there. Mm-hmm. So I think that was more that's how we approach mm-hmm. taking hold of a space. Because one of the other things they said was the rhythm has kind of got to change every 3 or 4 minutes, because mm-hmm. people will be with you, and then if it stays the same mm-hmm. after that long, they're off. Mm-hmm. So you've got to keep changing it. And we decided to do that, take hold of a space with live music, but yeah. the other companies didn't.
At what point did you recognise that you were starting to take control? Because you were saying about how the early stages was not so much about being in control.
2-man show.
Okay.
Really? Would you say not until then?
Yeah, I would say we definitely tried.
Yeah.
We definitely tried to be in control. We increased our... I think every time we made more and more meaningful, controllable decisions. Mm. But I don't think that we made what we meant to make until 2-man show. I think 2-man show was the first time I was like, yeah, that's what I mean. Mm. I think every other time before that, we got to the end and I was like, okay, so this is what we've made. It's definitely not what I planned, but here we are and I like it. Mm. It's the first time that when people ask me questions about it, I'm not like, oh yeah, whoops, about anything.
Yeah. Because I feel like there was a bit of a shift that happened around the Ugly Sisters, actually, but we came in and out after that time. But I felt like something kind of landed in that show, because there was something quite simple about that show in a way. It was like the story was quite simple. But I think there was something about the genre that felt kind of whole in a way that it hadn't done before. Like,
I feel like that is when we took control of the form. That is when we made a load of decisions that were like, yes, the costume makes sense, and that, you know, we're not just wearing black leggings so no one sees our bum, which is essentially what we've done at every other show. Like, the costumes made sense, the set made sense, we'd worked with a designer in the kind of, in for the first time?
Yes, I think probably, yeah.
There was the concept, we saw through a concept from beginning to end that we intended to see through, but what we were saying was kind of underwhelming and obvious and not very radical.
Yeah.
So
it was like a fun show.
Yeah, we took control of all of the things that meant, and everything meant what we meant it to mean, I think, but what we actually meant wasn't that great.
Yeah.
Whereas a two-man show, form and content came together for the first time.
Yes, I would agree with that.
I thought I could tell you with words who I am, with words how funny of me. I wake you up in the middle of the night to ask what it's like to be you. I wake you up in the middle of the night to ask what it's like to be you. I wake you up in the middle of the night to tell you I'm not scared of who you really are. I wake you up in the middle of the night to tell you I'm not scared of who you really are. I thought I could tell you with words who I am, with words how funny of me. I thought I could tell you with words who I am, with words how funny of me. I wake you up in the middle of the night to ask what it's like to be you. I wake you up in the middle of the night to ask what it's like to be you really are. I thought I could tell you with words who I am, with words how funny of me. I thought I could tell you with words who I am, with words.
Was that the first script that you published?
Yes, two-man show was.
Yeah, because I was just reading yesterday the interview on your website with Maddie Costa, in which you talked about at that time, whenever that interview was taken, that you were working with Alice Birch because you felt that as writers you weren't able. Has that changed? Do you feel that that's changed since the two-man show?
The intention has changed. Mm-hmm. I think we're both more interested in writing and being good at writing than we were then.
And I'm not sure, actually. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm in a process of thinking about that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I definitely, like when we started working with Alice particularly, I kind of went, oh, I don't want to do writing anymore, because mm-hmm. you're a proper playwright, mm-hmm. and I really enjoyed working with her in that way. Mm-hmm. And then Abby quite quickly after that got more interested in writing again, mm-hmm. and did pretty much all of the writing for the company, mm-hmm. that is text, mm-hmm. character text.
Not lyrics.
Mm-hmm. And then more recently, I've kind of gone, oh, but maybe I miss the kind of grappling with text again. So, but I'm personally not sure. I'm just sort of in a bit of a process at the moment, mm. of trying to work out whether that's the thing I want to do more of, or whether I was right the first time and going, no, I'll leave that there.
It was a very interesting script, you know, the script of the two-man show.
Two-man show.
Yeah, in the sense that it had photographs, it had drawings, it had,
yeah.
you know. And also, what was quite striking about it for me was this decision to credit it to the company rather than to the individuals who mm-hmm. might have written the words. It's something that has broken a lot of ensembles, you know, this idea of who do you attribute the script to, you know.
Three Sisters is different. I think we say lyrics by Abby, Helen and Becky, text by Abby, with Helen and Becky, I think, because although I assembled the words, lots of the words had come from free writing that everyone had done. It is a lot more... It's a tricky one. I feel like it's nice to be clear in crediting so that people know how it comes together. I don't know whether this is just a British thing, but it does feel like there is such an emphasis on words in British theatre that the reason that we have been so particular about what we do when, who we say does what, specifically with words, because you notice that no one really cares who came up with the idea, original, you know, all of that stuff, is because people think that the writer kind of invents it. But there's just so much invention that goes on between all of us. There's so many discoveries that are made that it's impossible to find the percentage of that idea who it belongs to.
Because it's alchemy, and it's and that's like one of the exciting things about working.
Yeah.
But I think it also depends on the process as well, because like Two Man Show and Three Sisters were quite devised processes. Where a lot happened in the room all together in terms of like discoveries. Not everything, but like quite a lot. But then there are other processes that we might do that are more written, and then other elements get added in. So I guess that would then be a different thing in terms of how to credit that and how to talk about that.
But they haven't really come to fruition yet.
No,
that's the thing. Like, none of the ones where we've worked differently, that's kind of something that we've been working on a few of those projects for a while, but none of them have happened yet. So it's hard to know how a relationship with writing has changed until it's changed, and it's just in the process of changing.
And can you describe your process then? What happens when, you know, like you have the initial kernel for an idea, and then how does it develop into a show?
It really changes from show to show. The process characterizes the form, and the form characterizes the content. And of course, the people in the room characterize the process. So it kind of goes people, process, form, content in terms of like those ripples in. And I think we're becoming clearer and clearer on that. So getting the people in the room to begin with, and with our next show, which if we get the funding for, we will make with my mum and a musician called Yusuf Ahmed, who is a jazz drummer. The process is very different because of those people and what they bring in the room. They're actually both, even though they've never met each other before working together, really interested in Carl Jung and his philosophy and his work with subconscious. And so our process, which is firmly rooted in the conscious, I think, is suddenly being completely disrupted by people who are interested in the subconscious. And that is going to make that process very different, because I imagine we'll go more into authentic movement, we'll go more into processes that allow subconscious to flow through, which we've never explored. But with Three Sisters, we went on a journey that was, we were angry with the play, we were angry that we had to do a piece from the canon in order to be taken a certain kind of seriously. And so the first thing we thought we would do is do the play without having read the play. I mean, we've all read the play and seen the play at various stages, but not, you know, refresh, do no refreshing. And actually then what we ended up doing was reading the play. Everyone took out the quotes from the play, no matter who said them.
And you already had all five people in the room at the start.
This was initially just Helen, Becky and I. And that was a funding decision. We couldn't apply for more than £50,000 because we thought we wouldn't get the funding. So we only had the musicians join us after a lot of the original concept work had been done, which is a shame, and I would like to have done it differently.
So you went through the script?
Went through the script. Everyone took out the words that they liked, that they thought, this does resonate with me. Because that thing that people always say about the canon, where they're like, you know, but it still resonates years on. And it's like, well, some of it really fucking doesn't. So we took out the stuff that did, no matter whether it was a man or a woman. We were like, I want to say that. And then we also wrote things that we wanted to say in a drawing room. So if you put the three of us in a drawing room and you said, just talk about your lives, we wrote some stuff that we were thinking about. And then we mushed them together and we gave them the structure, the 4-act structure that Three Sisters has, which is
In the first one, it's Irina's birthday, and they're going to have a party that night, or they're going to have dinner that night. In the second one, there's a party that evening that doesn't happen. In the third one, there's a fire somewhere, and that became a kind of version of Grenfell in our third act. And in the fourth one, people are leaving, and that became, we all moved to London, now everyone's moving away. So we tried to find the parallels between the thing, the undercurrent thing that's happening in each act, which held the drawing room scenes together, and in between we said, well, we'll do those drawing room scenes, but in between we'll just sing songs and dance about stuff that we want to sing songs and dance about. So that became the songs that we wrote, but it also became us talking about art and bashing our head against the fact that we were supposed to be reproducing the work of dead white men in order to be taken seriously as artists.
At what point do the songs come into the process, and how? I mean, is it that classic question, does it start with music or with text, and, you know, how...
They come in quite early, I think, like, normally. Like, often things are sort of happening concurrently, so we're sort of having dramaturgical conversations and going, like, oh, what about, okay, do we have this space that is the drawing room where we all get to talk, and... We were talking a lot about rooms in that particular show, in the development process, and talking about, yes, this main drawing room, and then these, like, solo rooms that come off it. So Irina's got her room, and Olga's got her room, and Masha's got her room. What are in those rooms? So everything was kind of happening at once, because which would be dependent sometimes on what we fancied doing that day. And if someone fancied writing some lyrics, or we all fancied writing some lyrics, then, oh, okay, then there's something for Becky to start writing some music to, and now a song's arrived. But then songs were still getting written, like, right up until the very end, and one of them we only finished in tech. So, yeah, I think they keep going through.
But so, we swing between the big picture and the small picture, so we go, okay, we think we're making this, and then we start making stuff, and then we go, okay, we've made this stuff, and it doesn't fit in that big structure, so now the big structure changes. Okay, so we think we're making this. And we never really solve the problem until previews. We never solve what the dramaturgical structure is until right then. Making small bits of the show means we're creating problems that we've got to dramaturgically solve later. But that's how we do it, and that's how we did through two-man show as well, a version of that, continuing to make stuff even though we don't know what shape we're going to put that stuff in. But then as soon as you've made something that you like enough, that is the heart of the show, we're like, well, we know that this is in the show, so now we've got to find a dramaturgical structure that means that that makes sense. That's how we do it, really, isn't it? We create problems to solve.
And create things that we really like, that feel like the most important thing.
And usually the things that we really like are movement or music. I feel like the things that we really like are very rarely text. Maybe Man Woman was one of those text problems for us at one point, but usually it wasn't Dan and John. They weren't the problems to solve. The things that we really loved, like the reviews rap, we knew that was in there. We knew it was towards the end. That's just a problem to solve, but that's in it, you know.
In the Three Sisters.
In Three Sisters,
Does Becky always respond to the lyrics, or does she bring music sometimes?
It never starts with music. Although, actually...
Sometimes it does.
It's my mum.
Yeah.
Yeah, she had a riff for years that she'd been waiting for, and then she realised it was for this.
I think it's high time women got on with writing original plays rather than mucking about with classics. At the barely graduate age of 22, she's still clearly going places. I just wish she'd stop detouring to the Shell's housing, the European repertoire. The problem is that the production feels like an arbitrarily imposed concept. You have a director who apparently sees Chekhov's play as a piece of Polish absurdism, one filled with interminable silences betokening spiritual desolation. On top of that, you have man's translation that is free with four-letter words and a group of American actors whose forte is domesticated neurosis. The result is like an anachronistic mix of man and man. Admittedly, the sisters are well characterized. Woman's Masha has exactly the right sensuous longing. Woman's Irish accent in Irina has an unusual vehemence, and woman's Olga shudders at the mere touch of the servant of music, Natasha. All these, along with man's called Kooligan, are good performances. They're good performances, but they would have fitted equally well into a more conventional production directed by man. The evening might appeal to those who've not seen the play before or have no taste. The sadness is that the three principles, woman, woman, and woman, combine expressive intensity with folk cover beauty. They silent resentment at the curtain call. I apply one simple test to so-called director's theatre. Does it enhance or diminish the actors? If it does the former, it's fine by me. It's fine. Oh, Amanda is obviously a fine actor, but she is forced to play MASH reversed as a vampish neurotic. The pathos of Arena's decline into a provincial postal worker is also undermined by woman's tendency to hurl herself onto the ground for tears, onto the ground for tears, onto the ground for tears, onto the ground for tears. Doesn't quite locate Chekhov's elusive brand of tragicomedy and the dynamics between the three Prozorov sisters aren't entirely convincing. Yet this lean interpretation has a strong pulse, and most of the performances are crisply defined. All in all, though, this isn't regional theatre at its most radical, daring, or exciting. Chekhov is the patron saint of disappointment. No one does the downward drift towards an autumnal mulch of ripe regret and sour resignation better than our Anton. With its offstage drumming and our pregnant silences, this is a production that is true lined to the letter, all the spirit of Chekhov, Chekhov, Chekhov. For all the ingenuity of woman's design, one also misses the exact passage of the seasons. That is another mark of Chekhov's preoccupation with time. Our best translators achieve a colloquial wit and accessibility. They're often missing it less my ears. Deceive me, the rich lyricism, the rich lyricism, the rich lyricism. The ensemble acting is variable. Some of them perform as seam at ease with the demands made on them. Others look as if they're awkwardly going through the motions. But for all their modish trappings, I describe both productions as good, some examples of psychological realism based on the teachings of man. There is pleasure to be had for both productions, but I rarely feel the force of unexpected revelation. Despite the ingenuity of the designer man, the stage picture is not perfect. There's a lack of fir trees in the final act, but it's a richly satisfying thing, cause there's good acting here.
There is good acting here, there is good acting here, there is good acting here, there is good acting here.
Within the crude concept, there are some good ideas, but the good ideas are vitiated by the nerve-breaking slowness and overtly signaled desperation.
Standardized check off, but when you detach it from the material world, you risk throwing out the baby with the bathwater. With the bathwater,
it's a good sentimental cliche and has moments of psychological sharpness. I miss the textured symphonic realism and emotional fullness of vintage check off.
Although I have seen more grandiose versions, I have rarely encountered one that brought out so clearly the play's real protagonist.
But this is a production that gets to the drama's heart and made me realise all over again why
I love Chekhov.
Not a landmark production, but I file this under interest.
If you like your Chekhov done in an orthodox style, what?
This isn't for you.
This is certainly not your standard Chekhov.
But the acting is uniformly good.
There is good acting here, there is good acting here, there is good acting here, there is good acting here.
Was the two-man show different then to the three sisters you just described in terms of how it came about? Because it was smaller and more intimate, maybe.
Yeah.
The process started with just the two of us. Mm-hmm. Becky actually came in later to mm-hmm. that one. And it first of all started with a lot of reading and a lot of research, which is sometimes a really important part mm-hmm. of our process. So we were doing reading about the origins of patriarchy. We were going to the British Library and reading a lot about language and when language, or the British language, was first written down, and like how grammar was created and all of that kind of stuff, and learning about how he was the pronoun that was
more comprehensive.
Just all of this stuff about how patriarchy is instilled in language, and therefore how do we think in a non-patriarchal realm if we can't, if we're thinking through language. So,
so this moment of the fact of writing it down kind of solidified patriarchy. Is that what?
Yeah, or contributed in in developing it, instilling it.
Well, it's when you say this is right and this is wrong, because everyone's using language in various ways.
Right.
But then the minute that you ban women from education and from writing stuff down, but you say this is how it's done.
Yes.
And also trivialise some of the ways in which are traditionally female to speak, like gossip being one of them, even though gossip and those kinds of conversations are really important in terms of the way that we relate to each other, but it's kind of like...
Talking about your feelings means gossip.
Yeah, that's not important. So all of that kind of hierarchy. So that gave us like loads of material, and we did loads of writing actually that could have been in a show, but we had a feeling that it wasn't, that nothing was really right.
It was all a bit on the nose. It was all a bit like, this is what we think about the patriarchy, which is not what we wanted to make.
Yeah.
Although it did make its way in one way, because we decided to start the show with a speech about the origins of patriarchy.
Yeah. So we kind of went into a rehearsal room at Northern Stage with a lot of that stuff.
Had we seen Angelica Liddle by that point?
I think so, yeah.
Because I wonder whether she was a massive influence on us in terms of the fact that she stood on stage and talked for 3 hours. She's a Spanish performance artist, and we saw her at the Schaubühne in Berlin.
Right.
And she... It was about lots of stuff. At one point it was about motherhood, at one point it was about Utoya, at one point it was about Peter Pan. And she would talk about what she thought, and she just would not, she was hoarse by the end of it. And then every so often she would sing The House of the Rising Sun and then talk again. And I think we just saw her and thought, we can say whatever we want. We can absolutely start the show with an essay about patriarchy.
And she was improvising the whole time?
No, I don't think she was. Yeah. She actually, at one point, for half an hour of the show, she brought on an entire orchestra and two dancers that danced to about four or five pieces, ballroom dance, five tracks, and then they went off and the show continued. Mm. It was epic.
Mm. Can you talk a little bit about that aspect of how you work together, the alchemy, the actual dynamic within the ensemble?
Quite often we just agree. That's true. Obviously, there are moments when we don't.
All three of you?
It's quite hard to unpick, actually.
Becky prefers to respond.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she also detests conflict.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You're not a massive fan of conflict.
No. Mm-hmm.
But Becky is... seriously conflict averse, and so she'll have an opinion, but she's not really interested in back and forth until it's solved. Usually she comes with the music and it's really great first time, and sometimes we're like, do it again, and she's like, yeah, that's pretty much how it goes with Becky. She's very easygoing. She gets very frustrated with herself when she doesn't solve something immediately.
But in terms of how we work together, it's very tricky, and I feel like I feel like we're quite nervous about talking about it because sometimes it's really important for us to name it and say what it is, and sometimes it feels like we might break it by naming it. I don't know whether that's right, whether you feel like that.
Yeah, I don't know.
But I'm nervous to say what I think, because I don't want to piss you off.
Yeah, but also I'm like, what do you think?
I know, but also sometimes when I say what I think, you're like, that's not how it goes, and I'm like, fine.
Yeah.
So I guess that's some sort of a mutual respect for each other's boundaries at the core of it, in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we've been working together for 10 years now, and we lived together for 3 of those years. It can be a very intense relationship.
Mm.
Much less so these last few years, because...
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I guess we just... our lives outside of the company have become fuller, and therefore that's taken some of the pressure off it.
And do you see it in terms of any particular compatibilities? You know, my previous project was about ensemble theatre, and I was interviewing various kinds of ensembles and various ensemble models kind of emerged from that. And one that I found interesting was being told about how in one particular ensemble, what really helped it was the way in which each core member kind of brought a very specific, you know, function to the working of the whole, the whole became greater than the sum of its parts because everybody took a very particular role.
It's difficult because I feel like when we started the company, we started it because we both wanted to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And actually, that makes it sometimes hard when it feels like we couldn't or shouldn't in this particular story.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, who gets to do that bit? And who gets to do that bit? It's sad not to get to do everything you want to do. Not just in terms of what we do in terms of making and performing, but also what we do outside of that for like strategizing and administrating and that kind of thing. Like, it's taken us a really long time to do different bits of that as well. Like, it's only very recently that we've become almost solely responsible for different parts of administrating the company as well, because we would both just do everything. And that took a lot of communicating all the time, because if an email comes in and either one can respond, you have to decide who's going to respond, mm-hmm. rather than just knowing, well, that's my job.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure, I know that we do have like quite different things that we bring.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's like, I don't know, it's hard. I think that one of the things that I find hard about naming the different things that we bring, mm-hmm. is that obviously it's quite particular when you're working in a dynamic with someone, mm-hmm. because you kind of complement each other, and you sort of yin and yang, and you like fit together and you kind mm-hmm. of make it work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I feel like in going, I'm this and you're this, I worry for myself, because I don't know how you feel, that I will then say to myself, I don't do that, mm-hmm. like in another context.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's something that I'm conscious of for myself, of not wanting to kind of shut down, just because it's not my natural instinct in this dynamic.
Because it might be your instinct in a different dynamic.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. But that's purely like a kind of self-preservation mm-hmm. thing of like just making sure that my own narrative about myself doesn't become
narrow.
Entirely dependent on this dynamic, because this might not always be the way that we do things for a number of reasons. Mm-hmm. Like if one of us takes time off or has a baby or like, you know, things might change, and I can't be scared of, oh, but I don't do that bit, because I suppose because I do want
to grow still.
Yeah, and to find new things.
Great.
Yeah.
I feel like that's the negative side of it. For me, like the positive side of naming it sometimes is that I don't have to try and be good at something that I'm not good at.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Like I know that I really struggle towards the end of a process when we're in previews. And we've already put all of this energy into getting so far, continuing to keep making the show better and better. I don't have the same finishing capacity as Helen does. I like making massive changes. I like going, oh yeah, we've done this wrong. We're going to rearrange all 5 scenes. We're going to do it backwards. And that's right. And I like the big solutions. I love the big dramaturgical shifts, and I'm satisfied by them. And I'm like, done. But I am really terrible at the just let that beat last one moment there. And then this light needs to go 2 seconds slower. And that kind of detail stuff, I like not having to be good at that, because I'm not, and it makes me quite stressed, I think, and then I can be a more agitated, angry version of myself in tech, and which is, you know, a really important time in a rehearsal process. It just, if I'm doing that, it takes me so much of my energy, because that's not what I'm good at, that I become a less nice version of myself. And then it also takes my energy away from being a good performer. So it's nice for me to go, Helen's got that.
Mm-hmm.
I'll see what I see, mm-hmm. but I don't need to mm-hmm. squeeze something that isn't there that I haven't got.
Because I guess in like one of the simple versions mm-hmm. of going, how do we complement each other, mm-hmm. is going, Abby's really good at starting.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm good at finishing.
Great.
And Abby gets a lot of energy from like coming up with an idea and beginning a process, and just the imagining thing. And sometimes I feel a bit like, oh god, we've got to start from the very beginning, and that can feel like quite heavy and quite like and daunting.
Yeah.
But that
particularly is one of the things that
we don't want to buy into.
Yeah, I suppose I can't buy into that too much because I don't want to entirely go, oh, well, I never have to do that. Even though sometimes it's really nice not to have to do that. But I actually, when I was running a workshop recently in Leeds, I actually chose to run a workshop about starting projects because I was, and I kind of held my hand up at the beginning on when I find this a daunting thing and I work with someone who is very good at doing it and I could, if we continue to work together for the rest of our careers, I could go, I never have to do that bit, but I don't think I want to. So I've got some ideas of like how to start finding like material to work with. Let's all do that, which was kind of, which was interesting. And I'm definitely, it's definitely something that I'm trying to kind of work on for myself because yeah, and I guess that it feels to me, and of course it's always particular from the position that you're in, but when you talk about finding it relaxing because it's, if you don't have to end a project, I'm kind of like, I feel like you'll always be able to find people to do that for you.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Because I can't do it. I just don't think I have it.
But if that feels like a that feels like a simpler thing, yeah. Whereas like finding a starting point feels to me like a more essential thing. If we were to not work together, I suppose. Unless I was to collaborate with someone else who was like, oh, what about this? And then I could, you know.
Yeah.
So that's, but as I say, that's me coming from my particular position. And you might go, actually, no, I don't agree with that at all. And they're both equally.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess if I think about directing something on my own, because that's the situation in which I'd be trying to finish something high standard.
Yeah, and the finishing is a big job in directing.
I'm like, fuck, I don't want.
You recently had to do that, didn't you? Did the show?
Yeah, we directed Hull.
Yeah, how was that?
We directed two shows last year, actually. Not last year, the year before.
No, last year was a disaster. The year before, we directed two shows.
Yeah.
And how was that for you? How was that?
Directing.
I saw Paul, and I'm just interested. How was that for you?
It's quite hard.
What do people expect from you when they ask you to actually direct?
Hard to know.
Yeah.
Hard to know whether they want it, because the thing is, our work has us in it. Mm. And it's so different when we're not in it.
I just wanted to ask you also, I'm not sure that I actually got a clear sense of how you feel about your work being described as gig theatre. How do you feel about that label?
I don't love it as a label, actually.
Me neither.
And I think it feels like, I don't know, and this is probably just my personal associations with it as well, but it feels like kind of like loud and brash and like a knowable thing, like you know what you're going to get from a piece of gig theatre, and I wouldn't want, even though that's like probably quite useful branding in some way, I wouldn't want anyone coming to our show and going, this is exactly what I'm going to get. Because I think I want to be able to be a bit more surprising than
that.
Slippery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My problem with it is it feels like a brand, and I don't really want to be making work that's in a brand. I want to be making, slippery work.
Mm-hmm. And I actually don't think, I mean, I haven't seen one of our shows, but I don't think our shows do feel like the way, like gig theatre.
It depends what gig. Like when we went to Bjork Cornucopia the other day, I was like, this is wild.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
But also, I do like going to shows that call themselves gig theatre.
Yeah, me too.
So it's not about not liking gig theatre, it's about not really feeling like I am it.
Right.
Yeah, right. I do. I really like Munchild's work.
Yeah,
I really
me
like
too.
Shows that are gigs. I really like gigs. I really like theatre.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay.
But that's why it's interesting that you say we were amongst the first to do it.
Yeah.
Which I also really like and kind of go, oh, that's really cool that you kind of recognise that.
Yeah.
But then I also feel like, I don't know, we're kind of moving past that maybe as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's really interesting because actually you have mentioned the way you use music is changing, and you have talked about having several things on the go that might take on new forms and so on. Do you sort of have a vision of where Rash Dash might be in like 5 years' time or something like that.
No, we're in a big transitional moment, I think. I think we're really struggling to make the transition from, I guess, small-scale studio work emerging company to mid-career artists with various options. I think we're struggling, and we're about to start working with a new producer that will hopefully really change how we approach that. We're working on various ideas of various forms. We're working with, there's a lot of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
We're also thinking about making a small film and thinking about making a project that's entirely, that is a gig. It's not gig theatre, it's just a gig. So I don't know. And I feel like it's not good not to know, but it doesn't really change the fact that I don't know.
Mm. It feels hard to predict at this point, like, what's going to be the thing. I have this sense that, like, there's going to be a thing.
Mm-hmm.
and that will sort of shift the direction in some way. Not that it will necessarily be like, and then that's just the thing that we do. But, like, there'll be some sort of, oh, okay, and then, but there might be a few of them. It might be, like, a big musical short film develops into something more of a film, and then a music project, and they might all kind of be like tentacle arms for the company that continue mm-hmm. for a few years, or it might be something totally different. But it definitely feels like we're sort of sitting in a soup of potentials.
Great. And it's a nice word.
Hopefully they're potentials.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much. Thank you.
You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Duška Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Bano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Duška Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.